to lives of citizens in Somalia. Many of the people that are being displaced in Somalia right now are not being displaced because of the civil war that displaced my family when I was a child. They're being displaced because of terrorism and because of climate change.
We're going to have to leave it there. Minnesota Congress Member Ilhan Omar. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
When I first came to Brookhaven town, way, hey, 90.1, there was no good music to be heard around, way, hey, 90.1, then one day I turned on the dial, way, hey, 90.1, there I found music to make me smile, way, hey, 90.1, I waited for a legal ID, way, hey, 90.1, the DJ said WUSB, way, hey, 90.1, they start each day with the rising sun, way, hey, 90.1. Don't ever finish till after day is done. Way, hey, 90.1. So if you want good music to hear, way, hey, 90.1. There's a station in Stony Brook you ought to hear, way, hey, 90.1. So if you like the sounds, do take a look, way, hey, 90.1. At WUSB Stony Brook. Hey, hey, hey,
hey. That's right, it's WUSB Stony Brook at 90.1 FM and 107.3. It's time for Off the Wall.
Thank you.
very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. I'm joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah, I'm over here.
Yeah, you are. You are. And
any questions?
Yeah. How you doing?
That's too bad. Oh, me. Well,
how are we doing?
I'm faring.
Yeah. It's been a rough week. It's been awful. It's been awful just watching the world news and seeing how things have been going. Awful, but also incredibly inspiring just to see how people are reacting, like throughout the world, not just in Ukraine, but surrounding areas where they're helping in many ways. And the way people are acting here as well. I'm heartened by that. It doesn't take away from the pain, doesn't take away from the horror, but it does give me hope that strength will prevail, you know, and good will win over evil. And I don't hate to put it in such simplistic terms, but you can't get more evil than what you see going on day after day. And, you know, I know this happens around the world. It always has happened around the world. In no way is caring about this minimizing that. No way. But when it's a country that's fairly close by, I'm talking about from a European perspective, when it's an attack by a superpower onto one of its former republics, the USSR, it's particularly horrible. You know, kind of like what we saw when Yugoslavia fell apart, but on a much, much bigger scale, because this is happening so much faster. It's affecting so many more people. We remember Yugoslavia. We remember Croatia, Serbia, you know, Bosnia, and Sarajevo, the horrors that happened. And that shook a lot of us up. But that's tiny compared to what we're looking at here, especially if it goes beyond Ukraine. And right now, there's more worry about that than there was a week or two ago. I've been worried about Moldova, where we visited not too long ago. I've been worried about that country ever since this began. Actually, I've been worried about them before, because when we were there, they were taking the first tentative steps towards embracing the West, democracy, moving away from Russia, from the old Soviet relationship. And they're right next door. So if Ukraine is first, you better believe Moldova is next. But will Ukraine be first? You know, they thought, the Russians thought they were going to take Kyiv in 2 days. It's been 2 weeks. And have you looked at the map? You know, every news network has a map that shows you the Russian advance. Not anything to envy. You know, you look at that and boy, there's an awful lot of country left and you're just barely scraping the surface here, and the people are really pissed off at you.
Yeah, the information has definitely gotten to everyone in every other part of that country, and the supplies and the sentiment, the will to maintain your nationhood has been spread out and deeply entrenched across that country. People are upset, and they know what this means. They know the implications, and they know the world has their back.
Yeah, yeah. And just seeing how the average person has stood up to this aggression, to this horror, to the tanks, to the missiles, and to the lies, to the propaganda that is being spread. It's so clumsy, too. You know, last week, I know you didn't want me to talk about Russia today, but you know, that's what the people in Russia see. That's the kind of nonsense they see, and it's gotten harder and harder to see it here. Rightfully so, I think, because you know, just because there is a different opinion doesn't mean that it's a valid opinion. Doesn't mean that it's based in anything that's factual. If it's all lies, broadcasting those lies is not an obligation that anybody has, and you know. We used to have shortwave where you could hear different perspectives from different countries, and some countries jammed other countries. But, you know, here we have a situation where it's very easy to get in crystal clear reception the lies from particular regimes. And I think we'll always be able to figure out a way to do that. So I'm not worried about that. I'm not worried about censorship. I'm not worried about, you know, opinions being stifled, even if they are horrendous and inaccurate opinions. But I don't see any reason why we have to help them in any way. And that means cable systems, satellite systems, they have the right to decide, because they always do, what networks, what channels they carry. And I see no good reason for carrying a channel that is spewing hatred, lies, and basically encouraging massacres. And that is what we are seeing. If you watch that channel, that is what you will be subjected to. And I encourage people to see it so they can see that, so they can realize what the propaganda is being fed into Russia, where they've cut off any opposing views. It's different, because there you go to prison for 15 years if you even help to spread an opposing view. So there is no equivalency there. No equivalency what we are doing here in this country with multiple perspectives on what's going on in Ukraine. But the lies that I see, being spread, and the reaction of the Russian people, that's something else that inspires me too. 4,000, more than 4,000 people arrested on Sunday alone for demonstrating against this crap. And that's how we win.
Wait, the lies that are being spread inspire you? That's the
opposite. No. The Russian people inspire
the reaction, yeah. And
their reaction to the lies,
the quieting of the lies. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I guess the lies are responsible for inspiring me, but it's because of the reaction to the lies.
I only point that out because there is this weird prism a lot of people are hearing through, and the more as you speak about this, if you are not specific about which regime and what you're talking about, you can start sounding like the propaganda yourself.
That's true.
Why I decried talking about RT the way we were last week, because if you weren't listening to it, or you didn't, you know, you just jumped in the middle of nowhere, or you didn't have context, you didn't understand where we're coming from, mm-hmm. you might perceive it as something that other than what it is. And there's a lot of that being weaponized and instituted and disseminated in the worst of ways to cover up and not take any responsibility.
Well, that's why I think when that does happen, that we challenge that fast and furiously, because it has to be. It cannot be allowed to stand on its own, because it's completely invalid. It's full of lies and falsehoods and things like that. And, you know, that's not to say that there isn't exaggeration and passion being expressed on our side as well. I think it was Pentagon briefing today where they said that something like 4,000 Russian soldiers have been killed already. And I've been hearing in the Ukrainian media that the number is around 11,000. So I don't know if there is exaggeration there. I don't know if it's inaccuracy. It's quite possible. It's quite possible. And this happens in wartime.
Well, these are official counts versus unofficial versus fog of war.
Either way,
times divided by.
But either way, do you realize what a massive number that is?
It's still obscene.
We're talking around maybe 5% of the total invading force killed. I mean, that is simply unbelievable.
It is so tempting to have pity and feel sorrow.
I do.
For the invading
but
army.
I do have, do you see the kids? They don't know what they're doing.
They're totally indoctrinated.
Don't. I'm not saying they all don't know what they're doing, but a lot of them don't. A lot of them if you look at the texts that have been captured along with the soldiers, you'll see that they're texting their mothers back home saying, I didn't know we were going here. We thought we were just on a routine exercise or something. And when you see that, you realize, and the way they have been treated after being captured, from what I've seen at least, is the way you should treat somebody, you know, not torturing them, basically keeping them safe. Last week we talked about how they even offered to release them to their mothers if they came and got them.
And it's so. Speaks so much, so it says so much, and I think speaks volumes of the the way the Ukrainian forces are handling it under the circumstances. Imagine having to do that to treat others better than they are immediately treating your entire country.
Yeah, yeah. It's a reaction like I've never seen before, though. And we've also had access in ways we've never had access. They talked about the Gulf War as the first television. I guess they talked about Vietnam that way, the first television war. But I remember, you know, invading Iraq or Kuwait, wherever we were doing in the 1990s. That was something that had much quicker access. You would know about a battle within hours or minutes. More so in the 21st century. But now it's, I'll give you an example. Right now in this studio, we are hooked into a live camera at Maidan Square, which is, I guess they call it Victory Square or Independence Square in the center of Kyiv. We broadcast from there, in fact, when we were over there. And right now we're looking at it. We're looking at that square. There's no people walking around now. It's middle of the night. You might hear the sound of, I'm not sure what we're hearing the sound of. You probably can't even hear it, but it's like a generator or some kind of electric device. I don't know. But occasionally what happens is the air raid sirens go off. And when that happens and you have this up, you're instantly transported over there. You feel the, just the, uneasiness, the fear. Of course, it's nothing like actually being there, but it's incredibly close to be able to get in the moment, to be able to see a war zone, potential place of destruction to the second, right now. And that's something that I've never really experienced before.
Yeah, I think it's a big part of what time period we're living in, and the proliferation of live webcams and sort of slow TV, people watching other places in the world. We've been marveling at this for years now. And of course, everybody's on streaming video platforms anyway for all their regular content as that's morphed. But this is particularly interesting from the perspective of a connected world. Ukraine has modern infrastructure, just like we would expect in any metropolitan city. It's a country of 40 million people. That's a lot.
Yeah.
And they're educated just as normal as any other place in Europe. Like it's just a place maybe a lot of people haven't heard of or haven't paid attention to in the past. But there have been harrowing efforts to keep them connected. There's all kinds of concerns around power and but infrastructure is allowing us to stay connected. It's allowing us to communicate, to find out what is needed. And I think that's, and to get reporting, the storytelling and the images out, so critical, and will no doubt be a part of a lot of the investigations and so forth. And there's just so many layers and layers of stories and humor that, you know, people are trying to find.
There is humor in all this. There is humor.
I have expect somebody to, like, you know, fund rides to The Hague and stuff. You know, there's going to be funny campaigns like that, mm-hmm. You know, stuff like that. I think it's all you have in these moments because it's so heavy otherwise.
Yeah. And you know, oftentimes it's kids that are cheering people up, you know, singing a song or playing with a puppy or something like that. It's just, and, again, you know, with live cameras, you can watch them at train stations emerging or crossing over the border into Poland, or just all these human moments that are happening right now. It's just an incredible way of just immersing yourself in this momentous occasion.
And people are finding ways and places, communities, countries, places like Moldova that do not have a whole lot, that are not in the same echelon as a country like Ukraine as far as development and foreign investment or mm-hmm. you know, where they are on the world stage or even people knowing about it, yet they're turning their gymnasiums and stuff into places where people can find refuge to get food and shelter and regroup find ways to communicate now that they're in a new country and stuff. That is happening in a place that itself is not as developed and big as Ukraine, but they are showing the bigness of their will and their heart to be there for their neighbors.
And they're really, Moldova, that is, they're really trying to advance themselves, to become more immersed in the world of technology and industry. And they've applied to be part of the EU, to be fast-tracked along with Georgia and, of course, Ukraine. And I really, really hope that happens, because this kind of thing shows you why these alliances are good. And maybe the Brexit people can take some notes about that. You know, it's about taking care of each other when something like this happens. And it's also been Putin, in some ways, has been the biggest cheerleader for NATO ever, because now everyone wants to join NATO.
And it really shows how much bigger that is and the resistance around the world is, mm-hmm. than a particular grievance with one country, with the U.S. or with one part of the world or one neighbor. And I think that's been really important to emphasize, that this is not a fight between great powers even. This is a fight against moral right, about humanity, about respecting your neighbors.
Can you imagine? I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but can you imagine if Trump got a second term? Because it's quite likely he would have taken us out of NATO.
I know exactly. This would have been a photo op. I've been saying this all week. It would have been a picture, signed deal, you know, shaking hands, done. Bunch of concessions, bunch of flimsy investments. Maybe even a casino hotel, and then that would have been part of what we used to think of as Russia.
His people are of Ukraine. You mean we used to think of as Ukraine?
Well, both, either, however you want it.
What do you mean? What we used to think of as Russia?
I don't know what is Russia now. Well, I mean, you know, we used to think of it as an equal and a player in plural rules-based society.
I took you literally. I thought somehow the country was being renamed.
No, I was sort of joking that, you know, they're willfully not participating in rules-based society, so they've been excommunicated from
anyway, it. Anyway, so Trump's people are going around saying this never would have happened under his watch. You know, and talk about lies. Please, please don't fall for that, because we all saw how he treated NATO, what he thought of NATO, how he chummed up to Putin, and basically is always a fan of military strongmen anywhere. And if there's any truth to that statement that the Russians would never have invaded Ukraine under his watch, well, the only truth I can find is that there wasn't a Ukraine left to invade if there was a second Trump term, because I'm sure he would have made it clear that we would not have protected them in any way. He tried to blackmail the entire country, for God's sake. He got impeached for it. These are all facts, so let's not even go down that road.
It just underlines how compromised he is, period.
I don't want to even talk about him, but it just annoys me when I see people rewriting history and trying to somehow point the finger at Biden on this. Biden has been exactly what we need at this point in time. Somebody who is firm but measured, because, you know, if you go off, you know, half-cocked or whatever the term is, and, you know, you basically say we're going to, you know, fight Russia right now in the skies of Ukraine, that is not at all responsible, and that is very dangerous. But at the same time, you can't just, back down and say, well, there's nothing we can do. No, we have to think creatively, and we are thinking creatively. This whole thing with Poland giving planes to Ukraine. Hey, Poland doesn't have their planes anymore. Poland needs more planes. We give Poland planes because they're part of NATO. Ukraine isn't, but Poland's their neighbor. They can give them all the planes they want. And, you know, the Ukrainian pilots are flying them, so NATO's not involved. And the thing is, and I think we do need to step down a little bit. There are people who are saying that Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, they're next. I don't think they are. I don't think they are, because they are in NATO. And if anything, this shows that Putin does respect NATO. And that's why he's jumping at Ukraine right now, because they're not yet part of NATO. And I do not think he will ever invade a NATO country. I hope I'm right about that. I could be wrong. He could be totally losing his mind. But his crazy reaction right now and his desperation to get Ukraine back tells me that he knows it's game over if they become a NATO member. And if that's his conclusion, that means he respects what NATO is, and he's not going to cross that line. And that's something I think we should at least consider.
Yeah, I don't know. Believing that I think is a little foolhardy, at least in my opinion. I think there's a lot to heart. I think a counter alliance would be more likely. That's at least what sort of evidence out there insofar as people standing up or standing with them. And I think that it's you know, having respect for NATO, I don't think is a constant. I think it is until it isn't the case, and I don't think NATO is necessarily sitting around feeling smug about that. Mm-hmm. I think that so far they've been on as much of a defensive footing as anybody could muster of time, and kept it at that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. And it is instilled confidence in the nations that are in proximity and that need to help. They need to focus on other things. They can't be worried about whether they're going to be attacked or not. But this, this thing stopping, that's the evidence that we need, I think. And it seems to, continue to grind on I think that Moldova will do as much as they can to support relief efforts and so forth, and that strategy for moving equipment around is, I think, the safest bet, because you want to do absolutely everything else
mm-hmm.
before anything escalates. And I think the whole posture, the whole point of the NATO alliance has been about de-escalation, just like we were talking about a couple weeks ago. It's about all the things we're doing to de-escalate this and not have any more bloodshed. It's been so needless and just for what it appears to be vanity for some individual grievance and with nothing but disdain for the rest of the world.
It is an individual grievance, meaning that this seems to be a Putin thing more than a Russian thing. And I believe last week we said that the one thing we hadn't seen, which was heartening, was mass showings of support inside Russia. And that seems to be changing a little bit, or at least the perception is being put forth that it's changing with this whole Z thing going on. Z apparently being a letter. It's not actually a Russian letter, is it? It's a symbol that is on Russian military vehicles as they are going into Ukraine, and it's become a symbol of the Russian military adventure that they are currently involved in. You saw a gymnast who was wearing it at some international competition, which somehow Russia wasn't banned from, and this is an indication why they should be.
That gymnast has been banned since.
And Russia should be banned too, because this is the kind of thing they do. There was a Ukrainian who won the competition, and the Russian had won third place. I can't even believe they were on the same, what do they call those things, pedestals? Or
it's a podium?
Podium. Okay. And to do this intimidating show of support for military might. But can you think of any letter in our alphabet that looks more like a swastika than a Z? Because I can't. It's pretty clear that that's the kind of symbol we're now looking at when we see that letter.
It's the 26th letter. Just
it's the last letter. Yeah. I'm not gonna insult Z, or Z as they call it.
Yeah, don't make more. There were a couple theories.
Except for the line from Pulp Fiction, Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead.
Yeah, it's on. It's taking a break. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Long one. But there's a couple of theories. I think one of them was even there's a translation, a Russian translation that means victory, and there was some association or statement that the Russian Ministry of Defense or somebody had put out.
No, V means victory, and we're going to get the V back. Okay?
Right, but in Russian, there's a phrase that would be translated to that, which is a little bit ominous. But
V was used in World War II. It's a great science fiction series as well, and many movies and things like that. But yeah, it's disturbing. And, you know, the Republicans, they ruined Q for me, and now the Russians are ruining Z. You know, we're just losing letters left and right. So this is something that I really don't want to see any more of.
Yeah. Well, don't, you know, they're symbols. They're symbols. We need to be more focused, I think, on the ideologies and the indoctrination and the savagery behind those symbols.
You know, it's a symbol. Getting a bunch of sick kids to stand outside and form a Z so you could take a picture of them. That's what the Russians did. That's a picture of all these kids from a kid's hospital who were, and you know, I don't think they did this spontaneously. They were forced to stand outside in the Russian winter and make a damn Z for propaganda purposes. Unreal. So there's also speculation, and this is really sick if it's true, that the Z stands for Zelensky, that he's their Saddam Hussein. He's their target.
I also saw that Z, like the word for West, starts with a Z or something.
All right, so we don't know what the hell
nobody
it means.
Knows.
But what do you think of Zelensky though over the last week?
Oh, he's got stamina and endurance because it's been a nightmare, and I'm really inspired to resist and I wish we weren't, you know, just spectating and commentating. It's pretty easy to do from thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
The guy's in it. His country's being just decimated, just destroyed, but defended at the same time.
Yeah.
And I just hope he continues to get the support and protection and rest, some rest.
I just hope he stays safe because he addressed Parliament today in the UK. He addressed Congress. Oh, those dumbasses in Congress. Marco Rubio basically tweeting out where he was, just basically making it completely unsafe for him. But Zelensky himself is pretty defiant, saying that he is staying in Kyiv. The government is going to continue functioning there. I saw an interview on the BBC by one kind of overzealous reporter who was talking to a member of the government in Kyiv, saying that if the government falls, that means the country falls, right? And where exactly are you guys now? It's like basically trying to get all the information possible that would ensure that they were defeated. I mean, I'm sure he wasn't trying to do that, but you know, she was being a bit cagey, saying, "Oh, you know, we're in safe places, and you know, we have a system set up, and it's not going to be that easy to defeat us." But you do catch these little moments occasionally. By the way, you know, I don't want Russia Today to be the only media outlet that we talk about. I want to talk about all the really amazing outlets that are out there right now, many of which you probably don't get on your cable or satellite system, but you can find them either through their own feeds or on YouTube. They have live feeds in English.
Can I say some of my favorite
networks? Go ahead.
France 24 and Deutsche Welle.
Yes.
Deutsche Welle specifically has been fantastic. They were outstanding in the first week.
Let's define what they are. First, France 24, spelled as you hear it.
Yeah.
In English. You can find that on YouTube, 24-hour feed and great coverage. Deutsche Welle, tell us something about that.
DW is the, I believe it's a public or nationalized broadcast service in Germany.
Yes. DW, look for that. Deutsche Welle and of course, BBC World News. I don't know if they have a live feed. They're on Optimum Cable on channel 104, and right next to them on channel 103 is Euronews, which is a fantastic source of news from Europe. I'm trying to think who else we have been watching.
Deutsche Welle was they were really good for capturing stuff from the UN because that wasn't really widely carried.
Right.
And I mean, Western media is just as soon as it's the weekday, it's just completely full of ads. It's really hard to get coverage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, CNN International, if you can get that channel, they're good. They're really good, you know, when they're actually broadcasting coverage. Like their sister network, CNN here in the United States, too many damn commercials.
It's like these 5-minute sips of information.
It's ridiculous.
Like 10-minute blocks of commercials.
What I do is, you know, I turn on the TV and I you know, I check CNN. Invariably, they're at a commercial, so I go to BBC or to Euronews or something else, and I don't go back to CNN because every time I turn them on, they're a commercial. But if you can get the international coverage, and most people outside of the U.S. can get that, and some cable systems in the U.S. get CNN International, they have really, really good coverage. You can also catch them late at night on domestic CNN. And of course, Al Jazeera English, I forgot about them. They are incredible as far as coverage of what's going on. I'm not sure how you get them in this country. They're on Canadian systems, but in this country, we're afraid of them because we think they're hostile, and they're really some of the best reporters out there. Al Jazeera English, try and track them down. And mentioning Canada, we also find ourselves with our Canadian system watching CTV, the CTV news channel, and of course CBC News. They have a news network as well. So there's a lot of good sources out there. You don't have to rely on the domestic coverage. It's all there for free. You can find it.
Yeah. It's pretty in depth, and there are a lot of really brave producers and writers out there on the lines, putting themselves at great risk to
being shelled live on the air. That's
do you know the brain damage from that?
Like, I know
the CTE from being around that and PTSD of seeing all that. I mean, I'm sure
we're getting the PTSD just watching
any
it.
Vet could tell you. Yeah, I mean, my last week I think I lived on adrenaline alone. It was very, very tense.
Well, you know, we've talked about veterans of World War II, some of our relatives who served in that battle, that horrendous.
You see what I'm saying? You see this?
And we see the parallels. We see the parallels, and I just wonder their perspective. And what are you showing the radio listeners just now?
Oh, I was just holding up my blanket. It's a green blanket.
Uh-huh.
And my grandpa took it on a trip to North Africa. And then he went around and like toured Italy a little bit and then came back.
you're neglecting to mention why he was taking a tour of North Africa.
He was just visiting.
He wasn't
Europe.
Just visiting. He was part of the military, for God's sake. He helped win World War II.
Yeah.
Give him some credit.
He just said he like organized which color ammunition goes with it. Do you know we have rainbow tip artillery? Yeah.
It meant something different then. But how did you come to have the blanket?
Oh, when he lost his license.
his driver's license?
Yeah, I was cleaning out his Oldsmobile, because that's what grandpas drive. And
are they still around, Oldsmobile? Does anybody still drive an Oldsmobile?
Yeah, it might have been a Buick after it. I think it was a Buick by then.
Wouldn't you rather have a Buick? That was excellent.
Yeah. And the blanket was in there, and he was cleaning out his car to sell it. Maybe it was a Ford. You know, it might have been a Taurus.
It was a car, okay. Probably an American car.
Anyway, it was, you know, long forgotten stuff in his car. And you know, I cleaned it out and I kept, you know, stuff that was in there. And then it ended up in one of my cars. And then,
Wait, why did the blanket always wind up in a car?
Well, you know, anybody, if you're in a cold area and your car breaks down,
you turn
on
the
heat.
Oh, okay. Does that happen often?
It's good to keep stuff in your car, and a blanket. You know, a nice warm blanket could help you.
I don't think I've ever had a blanket in my car.
Well, it's not a bad thing to have in your car. And if you maybe have to like work on it and you have to get down on the ground, you could put it down on the ground. I don't know.
Well, it's not in a car now. It's right here in the studio.
No. I keep it with me. Keep it close. It's a good reminder.
All right, Linus. Good with your security blanket there.
I have all the blankets.
Let's go to the movies.
Yeah, I'm ready.
I'll tell you, this week we needed to go to the movies more than ever, and we have been doing this for quite a while. Boy, has the world changed. We are seeing all the Academy Award-winning films ever made, starting in 1929, I believe, was the first one, and we are up to 2015, actually 2015 and half of 2016. Every year we have a domestic film and an international film that wins. And we're getting close to the present. Let's start with 2015. And Kyle, you tell us.
Son of Saul.
If it's the domestic film or the international film.
International film.
Son of Saul.
From Hungary.
Oh my God. Yeah, it was a week ago we saw this, actually. Okay. Yeah, we're gonna bring up the mood here. This is about Auschwitz. Well, about an angle of Auschwitz that you might not have considered before. These are the people that were forced to work for the Nazis. They were Jewish prisoners, like everybody else.
A Sonderkommando.
That's what they were called. And their job is to basically...
salvage valuables.
Yeah, that's from the people who were massacred.
Sort
in
clothing.
The, in the showers.
That's right.
Get all the valuables out of their clothing.
Salvage valuables, sort clothing, and drag bodies.
Oh my God.
Really awful, vivid, terrible stuff. And
this film, I would have to say, is the most intense look at that piece of history that I think I've ever experienced. Because
the conditions.
Well, it's like a documentary. You're basically following this guy as he's going about this horrible job.
I want to talk about that. You literally follow him.
Yeah.
It's eerie. You're very much like. It was always like a foot away from his back. So it's spooky, but you get used to it after a while. Did you?
Yeah, for the first 20 minutes, I was scared. I didn't know what was going on. We're just following this guy, and he's moving so fast, and he knows exactly what he's doing, and it's so grim and so awful, and you know what's going to happen to those people who are being brought into the showers and told there's going to be hot tea waiting for you, hurry up, do this.
The routineity.
And you didn't know, is he a good person or a bad person, but it was just so methodical and
bleak.
No way, yeah, bleak and no way out.
Yeah. So dark, very dark. And yet there are sub-communities and subcultures and alliances and relationships going on. In one moment, he realizes that a boy who had lived through the execution, but was then killed by an attending doctor. He witnessed this. He realizes that's his son.
No, hold on. I got confused too. It was not his son.
Okay, it was a boy that he knew that...
He didn't have a son. And that was emphasized a couple of times by people around
him.
Oh,
so he said that.
He said, okay, this is what happened. The kid somehow survived the gas chamber in the showers. He heard somebody breathing. It was this kid. And the Nazi doctors heard him as well. And they were fascinated. You know, we've only seen this happen once before. We need to know how this happened, medical autopsy, that kind of thing. And then they basically smother him to death. You know, he's not even human to them. And our hero sees that, and it becomes his mission. It becomes his mission to give this boy a proper burial, Jewish tradition. And that's pretty much the whole film, is him doing that. And in order to do that, he says it's his son.
I didn't get that. I'm sorry, I didn't get that. But it was the futility of this mission. He was just fixated on it. Mm-hmm. He made it his duty to do right by this child.
It was kind of weird because with all the death around him, for him to fixate on this one person. But I don't say it's not realistic at all, because that's the kind of thing that I could see happening.
I feel like there was this sense of needing to occupy yourself with something other than your duty as this assigned task. Remember the other instance where they had a camera and they did a distraction of some sort, and there was a camera in one spot, and they had a way of making like they were fixing something, and then they were able to take some pictures, and then he hid the camera because he knew that they would get caught or something.
Yeah, there was a plan, an insurrection. And while that insurrection wasn't successful itself, those pictures were key, because I believe this is based on a true story where pictures were taken and used as evidence of what was happening, because they had this whole routine down. They'd gas people. They would then incinerate the bodies. Then they'd take the ashes and dump them in the river. And these people were forced to do all this for the Nazis. It was the most horrendous thing. I'll tell you.
So he
that film really was a downer in many ways.
Well, he pretends to fix the door, and they're able to do things like that.
Yeah,
subversive stuff. Stuff
he hid the camera.
Anything
in a pipe.
They could to document the horror of, because it's so horrible. I can see maybe just you lose concept of reality. It becomes surreal, where you don't even know yourself if you, what you're witnessing is as horrible as it is.
But he didn't really help the resistance that much, because he was so fixated on burying this kid. He wound up losing vital things that he was supposed to give to people, explosives, that kind of thing. And, I can't say I wouldn't do the same thing, because you kind of lose focus in a situation like that.
Then at some point they organize a way to get out, to sneak out. And then eventually they're caught trying to escape by a young child. And there's this sort of cyclical nature to it.
Right. The whole thing basically feels like a single take. It really does.
Yeah, yeah.
And you basically swim across a river with him. And there's no cut in the camera. And he almost drowns. And you feel like you're drowning as well. And they wind up on this other island. It doesn't end well off camera. But you feel every second of their despair and their attempts to basically get out of this hell. And you just wonder how many people live that, and how important it is to never go down those roads again.
Yeah, and to fight every minute and in every way you can, no matter what you're condemned to in a scenario like that.
Okay, so now we go to the American film, 2015.
Yes, yes. This is an incredible film. This is Spotlight.
Spotlight.
This is a film that takes place in 1976. It is...
Spotlight. Okay, I my mind blanked.
Yeah.
Boston, yes.
It starts out with an interview of a child about abuse. And
in the 1970s,
that's right. Right. That's right. And then we're thrust into the Boston Globe and a team of investigators who do kind of like headlines, literally Spotlight is their feature, right? Yeah. So they kind of do consumer or like investigative stuff that's really like whiz bang. Like
they pick their own stories.
Yeah.
They take as much time as they need to investigate.
And take great pride in their control and measure and their reputation.
And Spotlight has a lot of respect.
That's right.
So basically, a new editor is hired. He comes in and he basically tries to steer them in a different direction to investigate all stories of priests abusing kids.
And they go quickly from what started out as this one case where one priest is investigated. And they, in their normal investigative work, meet up with a group called the Survivors Network of those abused by priests. Very, very emblematic of many different groups in this same area of interest, but also in many other, you know, nonprofits and people out there advocating for some cause or something that does not necessarily get as much attention. So this group enlightens them, makes them realize they're a little bit quirky. And then that's really well characterized in the film. Mm-hmm. But it puts them on a pathway, and they corroborate it through conversations with a former priest who had worked to rehabilitate abusive priests. Basically what happens, they realize, is that about 6% of the priests, and that is in this Boston area, 90 priests are probably being moved around or covered up. And they do that by creating their own database, looking at the reasons for priests being moved. They're usually these sort of specious or kind of unusual explanations. Mm-hmm. Especially when they're around an actual complaint, it becomes, you know, this weird unrelated thing that just coincidentally happens at the same time as a complaint.
The power of the Catholic Church is something that is really focused upon how they're able to crush these stories, prevent them from getting out, and how people react when told, we're investigating this, we want to find out something, oh, you'll never get that information, it'll be completely squashed.
When they researched it, they ended up having a list of about 87 names. So their initial, what they were told and they sort of didn't believe, ended up being exactly what they had in their own community. And it spoke volumes about the Catholic Church around the world.
Mm-hmm.
and how important this story is, how many people are affected by this story, this continues to go on today. In many ways, these have connections, in my opinion, to some of the residential schools and the way young people were treated
in Canada,
by the church.
Right.
And I think this is profound when you think of the hypocrisy of the Catholic Church in the context of their opinions about same-sex couples and queerness in general. They are incredible hypocrites, and this is a great story that outlines exactly why.
Now, a couple of things. We said that it starts in the 70s. That's when we see the first scene, and that is a scene of a priest being completely protected and the whole thing covered up. We fast forward to, I believe, 2001, and basically the story came out in 2002. And it was a scandal. There were hundreds of stories that were written about it in the Boston Globe afterwards. This is all true. This is all real. Cardinals had to resign, and basically it was a major, major scandal. What's interesting, this film came out in 2015, and the reaction of the Catholic Church is not what you would expect it to be. They welcomed it. They said this is something we need to see. They recommended it. I don't know how much credence you want to put into something like that if they really are that interested in fixing what's wrong with their institution, but wasn't exactly what I was expecting to hear. So fascinating on many, many levels.
Yeah, that institution needs to advocate for writing this much more.
Hey, right after seeing that, one of our favorite shows, a Canadian show, called Son of a Critch.
Yes.
We saw that last week. You can't get that in America. I'm sorry, you're going to have to pirate it or something, but it airs in the CBC every Tuesday night. In fact, it's on tonight. And the episode, this takes place, I think, in the 1970s.
Yep.
The kid wants to become a part of the Catholic Church, and the adults in his family, his amazing family in Newfoundland, they're not telling him about this scandal in the church.
They're all groaning. And
he knows something's up, but he's too young to know about this. The way the story is told is really, really funny, if that's possible, but enlightening and just very intelligently done. So if you can find that show, we recommend it.
And ultimately, they have a conversation around the dinner table with him, with a new priest, because... Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, one of the priests has to move.
Yes,
won't go
which is exactly what happens.
But they have a candid conversation with him, with a spiritual leader there who understands that it's messy and complex just as much as the adults do. But they guide the conversation, and
right.
I think that was really powerful for a sitcom,
And yeah, it's kind of like Young Sheldon. This, though, it's based on reality. Why is it called Son of a Critch? Because the last name of the person who made the series is Critch. He grew up in Newfoundland, based on a real person, and it's fascinating. So if you can find that show, we recommend it. Okay, so now we move into the first part of 2016. We only saw the domestic film for 2016, and what was that?
All right, this is an awesome film. One of my favorites, and it's titled Moonlight.
Moonlight. We actually saw this when it came out. So now we're getting to the point where we're seeing films for the second time. Moonlight, it really was a well-told story.
I will say Moonlit, the beautiful lighting.
Yes.
Of the cast, the use of color. This is also the epoch. This is now, we are firmly in digital cinema production, color correction. Outstanding shots in this. The edits, the music, the soundtrack to this thing is subtle but
very
incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to think, are there any white characters in this?
That's a good question. I didn't miss them. If
there were, I didn't miss them.
I'm trying to think. Was anybody?
Yeah. But
it's not necessary. This is a story about a particular neighborhood, about a particular group of friends and family.
Takes place in Liberty City, Miami, during a crack epidemic, and it starts out with Juan.
Oh, there was a white cop. I saw a white cop.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough.
He didn't say anything.
They were not the main characters, okay?
No.
So the Afro-Cuban drug dealer, Juan, finds a young kid and kind of tries to get him home, and then realizes his mom discriminates against him because of his drug dealer or whatever. He's out in the streets.
Him being... The
Juan,
adult?
Juan, the adult, okay. Bringing this kid to back home.
Because she also
mom.
Doesn't like her kid.
Yeah. Yeah, but she was upset the kid was going to be, he was getting a bad time, you know, bullied and roughed up in the neighborhood.
Right.
And so this guy brings him back and she basically tells him off and punishes him.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Basically, she resents Juan because he basically keeps taking care of the kid, teaching him to swim and things like that. But he's also selling her crack.
Yeah.
So when he basically finds her freebasing in a car with some other guy and says, how can you do this? You have a kid. She says, well, you sell me the crack. Who are you to tell me what to do?
The cyclical part of
it. But she also doesn't like her son, because her son is displaying characteristics of being gay.
Yes.
And, you know, we're talking about a little kid here. And, you know, she mentions that. So, the way he walks, you can tell.
She screams the F word at him.
He's beaten up multiple times in school for the same reason. Meanwhile, Juan, when the kid asks him what faggot means,
yep.
He basically says it's a word used to make gay people feel bad.
Yep.
And it's nothing wrong with being gay. And so it's an incredible and moving speech that was given to him. The story is about the kid. You know, it's in three chapters.
Three phases of life, yeah.
First chapter, he's called Little.
Little, yep.
Second chapter, his real name, Chiron. And third chapter, Black. Because Black. That's what a friend of his, who he gets intimate with, nicknamed him in middle school or high school. And it's just an incredible coming of age story, but also just all these conflicting values. And
I think it's what we tell ourselves society is accepting of when it isn't. Mm-hmm. When it isn't, it's a realist idea of what kind of queer people we end up with. Incredibly damaged, you know, people who have had as messed up a childhood as any straight person, but maybe a little bit more. You know, unaccepting of really, you know, base things that straight people might take for granted.
And I should also point out, this was the film that the Academy Award controversy, well, it wasn't a controversy, it was just a major screw up, where La La Land was announced as the winner, and they actually were up on stage when they figured out, oh no, it should be this film instead. And
I had seen the film, and I remember watching that presentation, knowing it was wrong, uh-huh. The whole screw-up.
Well, we didn't know it was wrong until they said it was wrong, when we could tell something was going on in the background. But
well, I know that we had both seen this before. Film, and we thought it should win, and
didn't see La La Land, and we could have seen La La Land.
Why would we have watched La La Land?
Because we would have had to have if they had won. So fortunately, we dodged a bullet there.
Do I look like I linger around in La La Land?
The projector's being turned off. So that's going to do it for us here tonight. Everybody, please, let's remain calm. Let's remain optimistic. And write to us, otw@2600.com.
And smoke some weed.
Absolutely. All right, let's think happy thoughts.